Coming up today, the UK gets a second 4G network this month. Plus, software has been created to scour Twitter for hate speech and record who said it and from where. And it looks like David Cameron doesn't just want to block porn with his filter tactics, he wants to ban a lot more. All that plus your feedback coming up. This is the Wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and the interesting from science and tech to witchcraft and online paywalls. I'm your host, Nate Langson. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk.
I'm Olivia underscore Solon.
And I'm Leah Clark.
And today our excitement bubble is full and bursting on a Thursday morning, which is when we're recording. We normally record on a Wednesday and put it out on a Thursday these days, but today, recording on a Thursday for ultra timeliness, Liv.
Indeed.
Yeah. Also, we've got a new issue of our magazine that's got Ranulph Fiennes on the front. It's a big special talking about extreme survival stories, how-tos, all that sort of stuff. It is out as of right now, listening on tablets and newsstands and things like that. So do check it out if you like the sound of extreme survival and how to do it. First, a quick one, because this broke just before we started recording. O2 will launch 4G data on the 29th of August, it was announced. Prices haven't been confirmed, and we are still asking O2 questions about contracts and things like that, basically as we record. But it looks like 4G will be available on contracts costing £26 and above. The first cities to get O2's 4G will be London, Manchester, Sheffield, Nottingham, Edinburgh, Bradford, Birmingham, Coventry, Leicester, Newcastle, Liverpool and Glasgow. And then next year, O2 will add a whole bunch of other reasons we expect. So if you are on O2 and want 4G, and if you live in one of those cities, might be worth giving them a call. See what they can offer you. Are you either of you guys on O2?
I'm thinking of moving. Vodafone has irked me.
I'm on Vodafone.
You're on Vodafone. Mm. Yeah, I think Vodafone's 4G is going to come probably within the next couple of months. We expect 3 might not be till next year. And then Orange and T-Mobile, I'm not really sure what they're doing because they're part of EE, which obviously has 4G. Anyway, we thought it was worth mentioning. If you are on O2 and going to be moving to 4G, do let us know. podcast@wired.co.uk. First main story of the day, Liv, something called hate brain.
Yes.
Scouring the web for ill speech.
Yeah, it is. It's a piece of software that looks for hateful tweets, specifically hate speech relating to gender, sexual orientation, disability, ethnicity, nationality, religion and class. And it's been created by an organisation in Canada called the Sentinel Project for Genocide Prevention.
Wow.
Which, you know, suddenly you're going from, you know, people trolling on Twitter to genocide, but there is a link, and I'll explain that. The Hate Brain is part of the HateBase project, which is a crowdsourced hate database.
A haterbase, you might
say. A haterbase, yes, which people could manually enter kind of tweets where people were being particularly hateful towards a certain ethnicity. And the aim was to create a database of hate speech, and it helps researchers to identify the spread of alienating and dehumanizing language that tends to mark the road to genocide. And you know, you might think that's a kind of a big leap, but they have shown historically that there are links, and so the idea is to help study the spread of hatred and therefore hopefully try to intervene and prevent things from escalating.
Well, and to identify areas where there is a dense amount of hate.
Exactly. So geographic geotagging of tweets and things online is important. And the Hate Brain does actually do that. It looks for the geotag of tweets for people who already geotag them. And if not, it will look for the biographical information that people put in their Twitter a profile.
Now, would this relate to anything like what we saw happening to our friends and colleagues on GQ this month who were inundated with hate and violent threats, even bomb threats, for publishing things that One Direction fans determine less than savory? I learned a lot about One Direction fans. They are bonkers.
Well, they are, but I guess what this hate brain is looking for, I mean, the things that they were saying were extraordinary and exactly the kind of things that would have been flagged up. I mean, there were all sorts of weapons being threatened to, you know, GQ journalists were having threats made against them about having weapons put up, dark places where you wouldn't want them put up. Mm. I think there was bleach in the eyes, stuff like that. So those kind of things would definitely be flagged in the system. But what it then looks for is kind of history of hate-based tweets. So they'll look at that tweet and then they'll look and see if that person has made previous kind of hate tweets. And if they have, then they'll include it in the database. If not, they might kind of wait and see if they develop a history of it.
Now, would this extend to things like rape threats, which is something that's been in the media a lot recently, particularly on Twitter?
Yeah.
Because it's not specifically, you know, this refers to things like gender, sexual orientation, things like that, but it doesn't specifically relate to
violence.
That was heavily related to gender, though. Yeah. Most of those rape threats were specifically...
But this, to me, sounds more like, you know, kind of misogyny and things like that, as opposed to just flat out, I don't like what you said, and here's a violent threat as a result.
Yeah, I mean, there are. I think those things are probably likely to come under this. It's not explicit about whether or not a rape threat it would be included, but it almost certainly would if it was associated with, you know, I don't know, I hate this woman.
Well, it was massively associated with misogyny,
but so. I don't know how it doesn't mention it here specifically.
Well, my last question, I guess, would be, well, there's two questions. One, is this publicising the people making these threats? And is this the first step of a bigger movement?
Yeah, well, at the moment, it's they're only capturing 750 examples of the hate speech per day, but which is 300,000 a year, but they want to do many, many more. But they are keeping it closed for now. So the database isn't just publishing all those tweets that teenagers make that they regret. You know, the One Direction fans, they made one aggressive tweet. There's not going to be a repository where you can see who all the haters are, at least not at this stage. But there is an API that researchers can use to kind of scan the trends contained within the database.
Right. Interesting. Okay. Well, we've got a story on the site all about this. If you search for hate brain, all one word, you can read Liv's piece. In fact, you did write this piece.
I didn't. Kadim wrote it.
Oh, it was a Kadim special.
Yes.
Well, thank you, Kadim. Olivia _Solon.
Yes.
Bitcoin, illegal if you're in Thailand.
Sort of, yes.
Says our headline.
Yeah, it is. It's not covered by existing financial laws. So what happened was a local exchange called Bitcoin.co.limited, which isn't, you know, it's not Bitcoin as an organization itself. It's a kind of exchange, a private company it's an exchange. And they wanted to register Bitcoin as a currency. And so they contacted the financial governing body to ask for guidance about any licenses they needed. And they went to the Thai central bank. And now the central bank initially said that Bitcoin wasn't a currency, so it didn't really have anything to do with it. But then later invited the company back in to kind of get to grips with what Bitcoin actually was and what the company was trying to do. And senior members of the Foreign Exchange Administration and Policy Department concluded that there were no existing laws that applied to Bitcoin. They were kind of bemused by the whole thing. And so companies that are trying to set up these sorts of large exchanges where they're transferring Thai baht into Bitcoins were deemed to be illegal. So they said that they couldn't do any buying or selling, buying or goods or services in exchange for Bitcoins, sending Bitcoins abroad or receiving them from anyone located outside of Thailand. And so this ruling's led to this company ceasing operations until the Thai laws are updated. It's a bit of a shame that the one company that was trying to play by the rules is the one that's been kind of penalised. There are lots of other companies that are still operating, and it doesn't seem to be that the Thai authorities are directly targeting them. It's more because they brought it to their attention.
But surely it means that rivals to this company are now getting some sort of weird advantage because their rival was being kind of honest and open.
Yeah, and I think Thailand isn't completely closed to the idea of Bitcoin. It's more just trying to understand what it is and how it fits in with its existing financial regulations. So I think, you know, the company Bitcoin Co. Limited did say it's illegal, but actually the Thai authorities have since come out and said, well, we're just looking into it, we're trying to understand it, and we're trying to kind of work out how we can then legislate around it. You know, this, the central bank isn't the legislator, but it is the banking authority in Thailand. But it, you know, trading between individuals of bitcoins is not going to be affected, or and completely impossible to police, even if you wanted to.
I'm still curious about when I'm going to be able to use a bitcoin myself, because I don't own a bitcoin.
Yeah.
And there is now a bar that's opened up in East London that accepts Bitcoin as a payment method.
But presumably it also accepts,
yeah, it accepts
your,
money.
The cards that you have in your pocket.
Yeah.
And money.
I still don't know who the average person using Bitcoin is, unless you're a drug dealer or buying women.
Yeah, going to one
on
pub in East London.
Exactly.
It's just a novelty to,
which Kadim,
to do it.
Kadim did and wrote yeah. about.
He enjoyed it.
I just feel this a little bit like a student going into a bar and saying, oh, hi, can I pay with a check?
Yeah.
Bitcoin, get out. The sun. Now, normally when we talk about this, we talk about the giant ball of hydrogen. But today, the sun is the newspaper. And the website of said newspaper is only going to be accessible if you pay £2 a week. This much we knew, because News Corp, which prints the paper, has put up a paywall. But it's also come up with an interesting way to offer access behind that paywall to people who buy the daily printed edition. So what it's going to do is print 2 million access codes every day in every copy of The Sun, which can be used to unlock this paywall. In the first instance, one code will give a reader full access to thesun.co.uk. And after that, collecting 20 codes a month from the paper will keep that paywall at bay, letting readers access online content. Now, I think this is a really interesting idea, because traditionally paywalls can only be broken or got behind if you either pay for a print subscription and get online access as a result of that,
yeah,
or an online-only subscription.
How are they? I don't see how they're going to make money. I just see someone buying a newspaper one day, having free access for a month, and they're not buying the print and they're not buying the
maybe
online access.
That's one question. But
that's what I'd do.
The Sun has a lot of sports content, which I'm completely oblivious to because I know nothing about sport except that it involves balls. And I think that a lot of its users will probably want that. But you're right. I mean, it's a very difficult thing to make money from because, well, some analysts and outlets have suggested that traffic for The Sun's website could plummet by about 90%, literally overnight. So they're going to need hundreds of thousands of subscribers to kind of make up the loss in ad revenue.
Well, there's the same thing happened with The Times. I mean, I know The Times probably has slightly more premium advertisers, but they lost almost 95% of their audience. But the 5% that they were monetizing, they were still making more money than the advertising revenue they were generating from all the huge amounts of traffic, because a lot of the traffic was coming from outside of the UK,
which is great for the business. And sort of as a side note, that it makes things a little bit more complicated for the journalists, because if you're a journalist and you've got a great story, particularly if you're a freelance journalist, you're not going to go. I mean, you might not go to The Sun necessarily anyway, but you might have gone to The Times, but you're probably not really incentivized to take your story there when you could get it much more widely read and have your own personal brand extended.
Yeah.
When you could have it on, you know, on The Guardian or The Independent or the Daily Mail or someone who doesn't have a paywall.
That's why when the paywall goes down, which I'm sure must be a tactical reason to boost traffic at the end of the month, but you always see big columnists like Caitlin Moran on The Times like saying, go, fly my pretties, go and take all the content from The Times, because they want it to be read.
Yeah, exactly. But going back to The Sun, I think this is an interesting idea. And there was a comment from one of the guys at The Sun that said they basically had to upgrade all of their printing presses across the UK and Ireland to incorporate this sort of a new printing method to print this massive number of daily codes on every single paper every day. And I think it's very, very interesting. But I did want to ask round table question. Do either of you guys pay for any online only access, like to get behind paywalls?
No, I do not.
No.
Well, I'm starting to get tempted.
I guess if you consider Netflix,
I don't
know.
No,
that's no.
No,
I mean, like,
no,
well,
I used to pay for The Times, and I think we have company access to the FT. And I think when the content, I don't, for me, something like The Sun, I feel like most of the content, apart from them, maybe they have the odd big scoop, celebrity scoop, but they tend to syndicate those stories anyway. And all the kind of gossip and stuff they cover is widely covered elsewhere. But something like the FT or the Wall Street Journal, they have content that no one else is writing. And that's where I think the value comes from.
They let
paywalls.
You read a couple stories free first.
Yeah,
I agree. For me, it comes down to method of access. So I pay for a subscription to a site called The Escapist, which is a video games outlet, and they have some really great columnists, and they have some really great talent for doing video game videos. There's a guy that does a show called Zero Punctuation, which used to bug me that I'd go to their website all the time and I'd have to sit through 30-second pre-roll, and I wasn't ever able to get it on my iPad. Yeah. So I paid, it was like 20 quid a year or something, but then I get all their videos delivered as podcasts, I get their columnists and opinion delivered as RSS, full text on my iPad. So for me, it wasn't so much about getting access to the content as being able to get access in a way that I want. So that's one I pay for.
There was a really interesting mechanism that I came across the other day, because I wanted to watch some online videos from MTV. I'm not going to say what it was, because I'm a bit embarrassed about what I wanted to watch. However, they have this really cool payment mechanism where instead of needing a card or anything, you sign up, you give your mobile number, and it texts you a code that you then enter, and then it takes, I think it was £2 for a week access. And it obviously, for young people who might not already have bank cards or you know, and just have their mobile phone credit that they can
use
up.
Paying for that.
And I thought that was awesome. I'd never seen that before.
That's
great. I would do that, actually, if it was that simple.
Yeah, it made it really, really easy.
Well, do you know what we're going to make really easy? Having a quick break. But when we come back, we're going to talk about swearing. So, time to mention Audible.co.uk, that place that gives you free audiobooks for listening to Wired.co.uk's podcast, and you can choose from 80,000 titles for being a listener to said podcast. A one-month free trial of Audible.co.uk costs £0 and zero of Her Majesty's British pence, and whatever book you choose to download is yours to keep, even if you cancel that account. For starters, and I say this because I've just done this, you can download iRobot, the original Isaac Asimov novel, or David Attenborough's autobiography, also just bought that, read by David Attenborough, which is fab. Head to audible.co.uk/wired, sign up in a few seconds and download any book. You'll be supporting our show every week, which we massively appreciate. So that's audible.co.uk/wired. Welcome back, second half of the show, where we divide things up into segments and then discuss them more in depth than we do in the first part. Coming up, we're going to be talking about a smart vibrator, and we're going to be talking about David Cameron's extreme filters, some new revelations revealed. But first, we're going to talk about rude words. Do you know what's happened this week? Of course you do. Russia has out-censored our own David Cameron by trying to ban swearing. So words like fuck and shit and
ah. Are you going to beep that out?
They're not. They were beeped.
What about...
That's getting beeped too.
Apparently Russia has an entirely separate language for swearing called what?
Interesting.
Yes.
Well, this is all getting banned. Liat, what the dealio?
I know. Well, yeah, they are 10 steps ahead of Cameron. Russian politician Yelena Mitsulina, chairperson of Russia's Committee for Family, Women and Children, has announced she wants to ban swearing, and she is not alone. She's got an awful lot of support, and it looks like this could quite possibly be a reality soon. Now, Russia already has a blacklist of URLs, domain names and IP addresses, began blocking sites last year. Sites can get unblocked if they remove the offending content, so it's not like a kind of blanket sweep just smashing down websites. But these blocks are meant for things like suicide, drug taking, child abuse images. Along the way, they've been criticized for catching up other things within this criteria, stuff like an encyclopedia website was taken down because it had a page on marijuana. So stuff like that has been happening all the time. Now, this new proposal would be added on to child protection laws that came into play last year, which allowed the authorities to block any content deemed harmful to their health and development. So apparently swearing has now been added to that. We don't want the kids to swear, so let's just ban swearing. New measures got support from Putin's deputy, Vitaly Milonov, who is the same guy behind the ban on the promotion of material that promotes sodomy, lesbianism, bisexualism and transgenderism to minors. He is the chairman of the Moscow Regional Bar Association, so he's a bit of a big wig. He's the big cheese. He says it's not against human rights, and if we don't swear in our daily lives, why should we swear online and expose children to that? Which I think is a fascinating statement.
He thinks we don't swear in real life.
Apparently, he thinks Russians don't swear in their daily life. Maybe he just means at work over the conference table, but...
But there is something interesting about swearing in Russia. I mean, as you mentioned before briefly, there is a separate language, and it does sound as though they can create swear words that are stronger than anything that we know of in English.
Yeah, I mean, according to the Wikipedia page, I was familiar with most of these words, but I think it's quite a rich culture of swearing that goes deeper than that. Apparently, it's kind of embedded in popular culture, things like limericks. There's loads of limericks and poems that are based around this language,
yeah,
map.
But it's also about context, and it's also about, you know, what do we deem offensive to ourselves?
Yeah.
And how do we interpret swearing? Because, I mean, I don't know, I swear like a champ. We all do, but none of us take offence to it, because it is, particularly I think for sort of people in our generation, it is just something we've grown up with, and we don't take offence.
Not necessarily malicious or nasty.
But then if you said it to your gran, they would be offended.
Yeah.
Well, it depends. But again, it depends. You could say something in front through a laugh that's not necessarily, it's not meant to be offensive, then it might take offence. But you call someone that to their face, and that changes the,
it's
all about context.
If you swore at me in a nasty way and you were angry at me, that would be completely different.
Yeah. But what I love about this is that it's actually just going to make people more creative in the profanities that they use. I remember I've got lots of friends who work for finance companies where they're not allowed, you know, there's screens of words they're not allowed to use. I don't know if we have that here. I certainly haven't ever come across it. But, you know, so they just use very basic things like replacing the I for a one, and that always gets around the filters. But actually, if you're banning words and even the kind of versions of the words, you're going to start just being really creative with kind of insults, which
like
I quite like.
Fans.
I do like the idea, you know, of sort of calling someone a, I don't know, you unmitigated sweaty jockstrap.
Yeah.
But it just becomes funny. Or Shakespearean swearing.
Or a prolapse chuffnut.
Yeah, it's quite
funny.
They're
just going to have to keep updating their list.
Some companies do ban swearing in emails incoming to prevent abuse or swearing or what have you. And I do vividly remember a friend of mine who works at a mobile telecoms company. I'd emailed him something that was probably quite obscene in jest, and he emailed me back to say, I'm sorry, our filters don't allow that email through. Can you say it again without the swearing? And I was massively amused. Massively amused by that. Well, do let us know what you think. Do swear if you wish, because we're not offended by it. podcast@wired.co.uk. Segment 2, Sex Watch. The segment where we talk about sex, the sex industry. If you have any younger children, you might want to just get rid of them right now. Go on. They're gone. Yep. Great. Liv. Smart vibrators. Syncing with novels. This amused us all this week greatly.
Yeah, I think it's quite a good idea. It's Vibes. It's a Bluetooth-enabled vibrator that will link to a mobile app, and it allows women to sync the vibrations of the device to any audio fantasy of their choice.
When you say sync, does it mean it's more intense during more intense parts of the book?
Exactly that.
Wow.
So you will have some audio fantasy. They've got an app which contains lots of different stories, some of which are one's linked to 50 Shades of Grey, the popular kind of mummy porn book. And what it does is it'll read the story out, and you would place the vibrator in the appropriate area, and it would vibrate in a kind of different tempo depending on the tempo and the intensity of the scene.
Now, they refer to something in here called the biggest sex organ, the brain.
Yeah.
Well, I like that term.
The kind of point they're trying to make, and I believe this is something that has, you know, has been shown in studies, is that women are less visually stimulated. They're much more needed to have their kind of brain stimulated. They need to have the idea of the kind of arousal in their brain, in addition to just like seeing body parts smashing together. And so that's why they're referring to as the women's sex organ. I think, you know, women's sexual arousals are a little bit more complex in some ways. So the idea is you have this story, it's read out, and you get aroused and also stimulated by the device.
Are they picking up on words or like the speed of things? Do you how do they do the syncing?
I'm assuming someone goes through and says, well, this part's much more sexy than
not automated. It's specific
the
books.
Specific books and fantasies have been uploaded, and they've been coded to be, you know, at this point, this is a more intense one. I mean, perhaps in the future it could be be done
so they
automatically.
Can't just do it off random, like fan porn.
You can. That's the thing. You can make your own. So if you don't like any of the audio fantasies, and quite frankly, the video for Vibes, which is put on their Indiegogo page, is massively cringeworthy. It's this really cheesy guy called Rodrigo or something who's coming to, you know, fulfill this office worker's fantasies. But you can get, you can write your own. So you might want to get a boyfriend or, you know, a sometimes partner to narrate a story, and then you can ascribe the values to the story of the vibrations, and you can upload that if you want to a kind of fan fiction area of the app, so other people can then take it.
I think we should do this for Wired.co.uk stories.
Yeah,
that'd be amazing.
Oh, what's how sexy is our story about Robofish?
Well, just think about as you're reading about, yeah, exactly, or the insect who had genitals shaved off for science.
I think there would just be, the vibrator would die. It would just stop.
Yeah.
I don't really think it wants to excite anyone with the sound,
I don't know,
of genital shaving.
So if any listeners are interested, where do they go to get this?
Well, at the moment they're doing pre-orders on Indiegogo. They're trying to raise funds. They're raising $15,000, but they've already smashed that target in a couple of days. You can pre-order your Vibes for just £45. It's $69. Ha ha ha. The old 69er. Yeah. And you'll get for that, you'll get the device, and then you'll get the app for free when it launches in a few months' time.
Can't you do it remotely as well? Do I remember this right?
There is a second app that Vibes comes with, which allows a long-distance partner to operate the vibrator remotely through the app, and it has a chat functionality. So that's a kind of another option there.
They are a bit one-sided, these. They are always for women.
All about the woman.
Well, that's not true, actually. There is another device called Real Touch.
Oh, no.
Which is a slightly terrifying-looking machine, which is designed to simulate any orifice you so choose, and it syncs actually with porn videos, and I think you subscribe to a website and it has done the same thing but with video, so much more visual.
Thank you, technology.
There is something for everyone.
Okay, well, it's time to leave sex where it belongs, in the gutter. That is, if David Cameron is to be believed, as we move into the last segment. Order. David Cameron has proposed internet filters. Now, we've talked about these at great length in previous episodes, but what has been discovered is that they are more than just hardcore pornography and Vibes literature, according to information obtained by the Open Rights Group. Now, this is the organization that campaigns for digital freedoms and has spoken to some of the ISPs that will be constructing Cameron's smut filters, and they discovered that a host of other categories of supposedly objectionable content may well be on the block list. Now, in addition to the sexy stuff, blocks may extend to violent material, extremist-related content, anorexia and eating disorder websites, and suicide-related websites. Now, you could argue that those topics probably not all that suitable for children, but also alcohol and smoking, and potentially blocking web forums and quote-unquote esoteric material.
I must say, this sounds exactly like the Russian law, by the way.
But hang on, I mean, I disagree with David Cameron enforcing these filters, but these are actual filters that exist already on with your ISP. If you want to put them in place, you have parental controls, and these are the things that are automatically blocked if you put in parental controls. So what the objectionable thing about it is the fact that Cameron wants ISPs to ensure that people have to untick a box when they sign up to the ISP, but you can opt out of it. I do feel like we've made a little bit too much about these filters. As if,
but I couldn't disagree more. The problem is opting out of it. It's basically saying, I want to access something you've deemed objectionable.
I agree
that a lot of this
stuff... But these things, it's fine for them to be blocked in parental filters. If I was a parent and I wanted to put parental filters on, I'd be totally happy with those things to be blocked.
Yeah, but that also means the way they're built that you're going to not have access to sex education material or Vibes, which I think is perfectly acceptable.
I guess that depends on how it's implemented.
But it's the difference between saying I would like this to be blocked and having control over it, and saying it's blocked and you have to act on unblocking it. And some people don't want to have to say,
But it's not. Yeah. I think it's not I have to make a phone call and unblock it. It is a pop-up box, which has a box already ticked. In the same way that you have, do you want to receive emails from us? And there's a tick box. And you have to untick it. It's not installed already. The filters aren't installed already. It's an untick. Or if you do tick it and you say yes, then you have to go and install them.
But we have seen time and time again that people don't read this sort of stuff. And people don't read EULAs where it says, you know, there's conditions in iTunes that says you're not allowed to use iTunes if you're using, like, nuclear weapons and stuff like that. And there was a competition, and I think it was for a games retailer, that technically said someone agreed to you owning your soul. And if you spotted it, you know, you would win a prize. And so few people ever win that prize because no one reads these things.
Yeah.
And I just don't think it's a good situation to be in necessarily.
See, I think what should happen instead of this, I don't think it should be enforced, but I do think it's probably a good idea, but for people who aren't that tech savvy, to have a box that comes up and just very clearly when you set up your thing, do you want any filters?
In plain English, what it might not block.
Yes or no, and you can opt in or not opt in.
Correct.
And warn you about what other things might be blocked.
Yeah.
Because it is, you know, time and time again, other stuff will get sucked into it that you don't want to be blocked, that you want your children to have access to learn about the world. Mm.
Okay, so we've talked about the reasons why this is beneficial, and I agree that children not having access to pornography and, you know, violent material and things that promote alcohol and violence and things like, don't get me wrong, I'm totally on board with that. Yeah. That's great. We know for a fact that our website is blocked in a number of schools because we get students writing in saying, I can't access this story because my school blocks it. We've been blocked for anything from, you know, sexual content
or
to violence.
Or this sort of story.
Yeah.
This sort of story.
And if a teenager is looking for information on transgender issues or whatever, they're not going to be able to find them.
Correct. But I don't think that... Maybe I'm being too presumptuous here, but in history and anecdotally, I don't think these filters work very well. And they do definitely block the obvious contenders. They block the porn sites that are on these lists, and they block known, you know, websites that promote violence or suicide and anorexia and things like that. But they also do block sites that consistently host stuff that could be considered objectionable.
Yeah.
And our website, I imagine, given even just some of the stories we talked about today, would probably class as that.
Yeah,
and I think that when this is being applied to all of these massive ISPs, and not just speaking selfishly for our business, but generally websites that do cover this stuff, it could be worrying.
Because it's done on keywords and URLs, so it won't affect things like Imgur, where you can upload any picture of anything pornographic, and because it's just a plain text link.
I've experienced it loads with one of my old phones before. I have, for some reason, automatically had it set up on, like, child controls.
Yeah.
So I had to call them up and sort it. But I was getting blocked access to the most basic normal sites.
And
I don't know, where can I buy this? And I click on the website and it would block me. So it was just infuriating, annoying. And I can promise you that none of those times was I Googling porn. I only do that at home, not on my phone.
Great.
That's what I thought. Well, let us know what you think. This has been a very heated debate on both sides of the fence. podcast@wired.co.uk. Now, in that inbox, Liat, what has been in there this week?
Well, Richard Bloyd from Lexington, Kentucky has been in touch. He says, heard Nate on TNT.
Tech News Today.
You were.
I guessed on there sometimes.
And you're on the podcast. Yes. And he's downloaded and listened to several of your shows through Podcast Manager Beyond Pod on his Android phone.
I think that's why he was writing in, because we were curious from a few shows ago how people listen to our podcast.
He says, I enjoyed them and found them information useful. The three-person format provides opportunity for nice discussion. So I have subscribed. Thank you for your good work.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you.
We always like to know when people do join us from other podcasts. It's a good reason to guest on other shows.
Yeah.
Mark wrote in to comment on the Cameron censorship story. What was he saying?
He said, be warned, people, once the filter is in place, however good the initial intentions, it won't take much to add objectionable content to it. And who decides what's objectionable exactly? According to this article, eating disorders, smoking and alcohol are already set to be filtered. Why? What does this have to do with Cameron and the Daily Mail's crusade against porn? And does it extend to things that are sponsored by alcohol companies or recipe websites where alcohol is used to make coq au vin? It's a slippery slope.
It is a very slippery slope.
Yeah.
He has a point. And maybe we are being a bit too presumptuous on how extreme these filters will be, but it is worth being aware of them so we are at least asking the correct questions. Well, you can write in podcast@wired.co.uk. Also, don't forget, our new issue is on shelves now. Ranulph Fiennes, extreme how-to, lots of stuff. An amazing story to do with ice. Definitely worth checking that out. And of course, don't forget to download a free audiobook from Audible, audible.co.uk/wired. It costs nothing. Why are you still listening to me? Why are you not listening to those? That'll do.
Bye.
So long. You've finished this week's episode of the Wired.co.uk podcast. Until next week's episode, why not download the latest issue of Wired on your iPad, Android tablet or Kindle Fire? Do so with a discount from wired.co.uk/magazine.